could be infected with disease. The words came fast. But the poison might not affect you. Poisons can be specific to species, and they do not have experience with your physiology. I can assure you of nothing. I do not even know if they are poisoned. I do not believe the Phippocats should be let in, but I do not know why I believe that. I am extrapolating from the behavior of crabs, but other animal behaviors may be more parallel. I am not offering ideal moderator behavior, for I have emotional prejudices against the glassmakers. But if glassmaker behavior is benign, then... He was babbling, so I interrupted. Seen anything else suspicious? They are waiting some distance away, still hidden by the forest. By my estimate, approximately 100, probably a full social unit. All castes and ages are present, but with possible overrepresentation of non-breeding castes and underrepresentation of juveniles, as was the case with the village that the mission discovered. They have obvious internal disputes. It may be the same group. That one had not been harmonious either. They don't have to be friends with each other, just with us. An interesting idea. Possibilities for dialogue may depend on whether the Phippocats are poisoned or not. I would like to analyze the Phippocats, although I do not know if it will be possible. The cats made me sneeze. Kung said they smell funny. Your olfactory sense is a limited but effective method of chemical analysis. Well, what do we do? I don't want to act unfriendly. A brief wait may tell us much. I am sorrowful that this response seems appropriate. I left the greenhouse, climbed up and down the ladders at the city wall, ran to the box and started talking to our diplomats. Waiting wasn't a popular idea, that's for sure.
Who would poison cats? Carl said.
This could seem impolite, Bartholomew said. Cedar had come running behind me, and her eyes scared me.
I knew it. It used to be their city, right? We're just some weird animal that they need to clear out. That makes perfect sense. But it's our city now.
We sent for Flora, the veterinary medic, to come and check the cats.
They're listless, she said. That's not good.
Stevelin said via Nye, shouting back in the city, that glassmakers were still watching us from the forest.
Their response to our refusal of their gift may tell us more than an analysis of the Phippocats.
Nye's tone of voice predicted something bad would happen soon.
Look, the vet said. Shallow breathing.
We're in big trouble, Cedar said. Lucille, we have to be ready. We should have drilled,
the vet said. They're bleeding from their noses.
Marie began to cry. I touched my vest and felt the knife hidden beneath it. It was a mistake to elect me, and I couldn't go back to a week ago and change it.
What would Tatiana do?
Let's get inside and start getting ready.
Words don't have taste, do they? But these did. Like poop. At first, I thought people would stage a revolt like Sylvia's, against me. And maybe they should have.
Get ready for what? You promised friendship!
Then Daisy climbed down the ladder and ran to look at the cats. She came back squalling in a way that changed a lot of minds.
Those poor dear things! Oh, I wish I could help them, but it's too late for them. We have to save ourselves!
The glassmakers are preparing to move, Steveland announced. I am sorrowful that they have returned. We have found joy in our community, and they must not replace it with barbarism. That didn't improve anyone's mood. Parents hustled their children home. The Greenies and the Beaties started shouting at each other about how we could have prevented this. Beaties up on the wall, Greenies down below, and I had to stop them. So I said, "Hey, if we can show them that they can't win, then they'll have to talk, right?"
"How do we show them that?" Daisy said.
You use arrows, stupid, Abidi said.
I'm not going to kill a glassmaker,
Agrini shouted back.
We have to, if we had been prepared, another Beatty said.
Cedar came running down the wall to join the argument.
I helped build up the wall, the Greenie said. Don't blame me.
Leadership. Here goes. Let's use blunt arrows, all right? I said. At first, at least.
What?
Cedar said.
What will that prove?
Hey, that's a great idea, said a young Greenie.
Lucille is right. Blunt arrows. We could hurt them, but we won't.
But if they keep fighting, Cedar said.
If we do it right the first time, I said, they'll see we want to be friends.
And so on, and that's how I finally got everyone up on the walls, ready, and just in time.
Steveland and Bats and sharp-eyed guards on the walls said that glassmakers were sneaking up through the woods, a whole lot of them. We heard screeching glass made, and it kept getting louder, and there they were. 20 or 30 majors scurried down the riverbank, and I yelled at them, Chucko! Maybe it wasn't the right thing to say, but I wanted them to know we knew they were there. They didn't come near the city, running full speed across the bridge to the other side of the river to set up camp. Not the ideal place, but they hadn't asked us. Glassmakers kept dashing out of the forest, dropping heavy side baskets at their new camp. Some of them started looking at the children's flower garden around the statue of Higgins. That marks a place where he fought with the eagles. The wind carried their odor. Even from so far away, they stank like rot. A glassmaker worker in a black blanket picked a flower. Another ran over to grab it, then a third, and a scuffle broke out with a lot of pushing and shoving. Glassmakers who were arriving dropped their baskets in the middle of the road and rushed over to watch. The fighters had cheering sections, and I could make out at least 3 sides. They trampled the garden. Then a major in a plaid blanket.
Him. That's the one. The leader,
Kung said, raised a club and shouted,
Chuari!
And the struggle ceased. Just like before, Cedar said. Down the road, they kept coming. The adults set up domed tents and unpacked their baskets. Plaid blanket shouted something, and little workers scrambled to greet 4 females, big, slow, and clumsy, just like the mission said. With them were other glassmakers, about 6, that were so tiny they had to be children, and they ran around in the garden tearing up what was left of it and chasing the jewel lizards that lived in it.
It's the group we visited, Marie said, shabby like she'd said. There's 1 fewer female and a lot fewer children. Could the young ones mature that fast?
You look like you don't think so, I said.
Something's wrong. They weren't hanging on by much. That might be the answer.
From the look on her face, she didn't like that answer. And me, too.
But what exactly was wrong?
The attack came soon. Some of them sneaked up through the trees with catapults built out of what we had thought were tent poles and began launching glass vials of poison over the walls, and some splashed on an old man, Bjorn. He got a fever and almost stopped breathing, but the medics acted fast and saved him. Our bows took them by surprise, or rather, the range of our bows, and they retreated quick, but a few got hit. Even blunt arrows can hurt. Cedar and other sharpshooters destroyed the catapults, but the glassmakers had balls tied on ropes, and they could throw well, with 2 elbows swinging like a crack the whip, so their attacks had range too.
It's time for real arrows now, Cedar said. We outnumber them. We'll win.
Abidi agreed.
Right. Let's kill one and see if they roast the corpse and eat it.
We don't want revenge, Agrini answered. We want peace.
We get peace, Cedar said through gritted teeth, by winning.
To decide the matter, we held an impromptu committee meeting in the greenhouse, which is near the wall. Marie led the group against real arrows.
Diplomatic, Cedar called it. An insult. Steve Lind didn't know what he wanted. Eventually, because I'd had enough pointless shouting, we decided that everyone could decide for themselves. So some shot real arrows, some shot blunted ones. They seemed as effective either way. Cedar entertained herself for a while lobbing flaming arrows at the footbridge. Finally, an old hunter told her that if she kept missing, the glassmakers would figure out our range versus accuracy, the way the mountain spiders had, and we'd lose an advantage. The situation lasted for 5 days. We launched arrows now and then when glassmakers tried to sneak up to the wall. Trained bats carried messages to Monty and flew reconnaissance, and the bats understood the situation, so the damn things tripled the amount of food they demanded per trip. People looked at me, wondering what to do. What would a Fippocat do? When owls and spiders attack, Fippocats run and hide. They're green. They know how to stand still. They can dig a hole in seconds flat. They can jump high enough to land in tree branches. They can slide down a wet, grassy hill faster than a ball can roll. And us, the big Fippocats, we were trapped with no way to run and hide. It was my job to lead, and I didn't know what to do besides act happy, helpful, playful, and gentle. What good was that? I was useless. Glassmakers had taken to drumming and singing day and night to harass us when they weren't screaming at each other. Our children whined that they couldn't leave the city and that it was too noisy to sleep. True. Endless mind-rattling noise, because the glassmakers meant to make us suffer. Our children made earplugs. We adults wondered what to do and debated too much. The old hunters and Steve Lind spent their time observing social order, eating habits, and fighting techniques. And we were learning things, but not fast enough. We couldn't wait inside the city forever. We'd go nuts. There was nearly a fistfight tonight. "It's time to kill the musicians," Cedar said at the committee meeting. "The noise is keeping the glassmakers awake, too," Daisy said. "What?" Cedar said. "Do you want me to feel sorry for them?" "You can survive hardship," Carl said. "Hardship? This is torture. Torture for me, for my children, for everyone."
"Right. It's making you crazy," someone whispered in the hall.
"Who said that?" Cedar jumped to her feet, looking hard at the people on the benches, and someone snickered.
"Don't be a fool," Carl told Cedar.
"I am not a fool." More snickers, including someone at the committee table. Cedar looked like she knew who, and took a step in that direction. "Time to be happy and helpful. My one true talent." "Well," I said, standing up, "I'm with Cedar. I mean, who doesn't want to kill the musicians? Voice vote. Purely advisory. All those in favor, cheer and stomp your feet. Let's hear it."
An overwhelming vote yes.
"Is it making you crazy?"
Cheers and stomps.
"Cedar said what we all think, right?"
Cheers and stomps. "Thank you, Cedar. It's what we needed to hear." I led applause for her as I sat down. She looked confused, but sat down too. Nye rarely left the bakery or spoke except to Steve Lind. The cats in the box outside festered, and the smell upset the cats inside the city. Our crops were being pillaged or suffering from neglect, but at least the glassmakers hadn't set fire to Steve Lind. We sent them letters tied to blunt arrows asking for friendship and peace, and they looked at the papers, but if they could read, they didn't bother. What else could we do?
Steve Lind. My leaves complete their nightly turn toward the east in anticipation of sunrise. Water pressure from roots and the night's high humidity result in guttation, and water seeps from pores on leaves like imitation dew. I ache with turgor, yet I desire to wilt. Fighting is disaster, flood and drought together. With my eyes in the grove across the river, I see the glassmaker musicians, their bodies radiating infrared light in the cool night as they pause to lap up water before reluctantly picking up their drums and raising their voices for another noisy song. They are small glassmakers, the worker caste. The overworked caste, my humor root suggests. And humor contains truth. They wish to sleep, but when the sun rises, they will be sent to the fields to gather tulip roots, though this is not harvest season and the tulips resent it. Indeed, they will gather any food in season or not, all the while generating more resentment. While the damage they do to the life of our valley is sad, equally sad is the fact that the workers will eat only what larger castes fail to consume. Parasites and hosts constitute a common biological relationship, but in this case, parasitism occurs within a single species rather than cross-species, a perversion of mutualism, a barbaric relationship. Were glassmakers always thus? I had fewer roots when they built the city, and I understood too little, far less than I realized at the time, and my communication with them was brief and limited to specific individuals. I should have, but did not, fully recognize that the different sizes of animals, specifically of the glass makers, meant something distinct from different sizes among plants. Plant size depends on our environment and age. Animal size is fixed by their type, like the genders among humans. Type can affect function and social standing. Equality among types is an ethical rather than universal practice. It is not practiced among glassmakers. Up on the city wall, a pair of pacifist guards patrol on soft-soled slippers, heeding any rustle that might warn of a glassmaker attempting to approach. In the greenhouse, a young woman watches my stem for warnings. Earlier this night, Fipmaster Monte dissuaded his pack from a quest to find and eliminate the source of the annoying noise, that is, the glassmaker musicians. It was a tragedy avoided, since the glassmakers would have killed all the lions, but would have suffered losses themselves, and I do not want any deaths. This is all I can report to the young woman as Lux rises and sunrise approaches. She and I pass the time chatting. Talking stems are costly to maintain, and chatter depletes my immediate stores of adenosine triphosphate, so I would prefer to remain silent in the time of great trouble. But pacifists find inaction difficult, and she must remain alert. 5 days of confinement within the walls have unbalanced the pacifists who require activity. Cacti and ribbons, still holding on to their winter hibernation anchors, release zygospores to grow into new air plants. Flowers bloom everywhere, and pollen and perfume traverse the winds. Spring is the most beautiful and the most impatient season. Plants must grow fast or perish. Even those of us who have enlisted animal help to overcome the seasons. Spring losses can rarely be recovered. And this has been a dry spring, adding to the urgency. Within the city, humans know this. Their own resources become depleted during winter and must be renewed. They are impatient, too, and fearful because they can imagine disaster and death. They displace their fear and anger at the glassmakers by growing angry with each other. Cedar provoked an argument last night when her proposal to kill the glassmaker musicians was turned down. Without Lucille's intervention, like water to put out a fire, there might have been violence.
We can't take much more,
Lucille confessed to me later. We are lucky to have such a resourceful and sociable co-moderator. I have an idea that may resolve the situation, though not easily. I must be brave and share courage like a mental gift. I have strong roots and innumerable leaves. The sun rises. Photons rush down, and I begin to split water into oxygen, hydrogen ions, and energy. I am large. My roots, laid end to end, would reach the sun. Instead, my roots are spread throughout our valley, and I know that as the day progresses, they will draw in a din of chemical complaints from other plants that increases by the day. Our helper animal has been replaced by a pest. Forward-looking plants worry. Our ecosystem is disturbed and angry, as well as thirsty. The most fragile is for me, for I can see the stars for what they are. They are suns, and they have their planets, and travel to them would be longer and more complex than I once believed, and yet the more I know, the more real the idea becomes. And these desires are unbalancing. My wants are no longer simple. Pacifists see the stars and dream of travel too. I ask them when, and they say, someday, and they mean it. When that day comes, we will go together, their descendants and my seeds and plantlets and roots. Pots are confining, but I can withstand hardship. This will be a sweet fruit of civilization. The combined efforts of humans and glassmakers would make it arrive sooner. A small moth flock, the first migratory group, has arrived from the south. Their custom is to bring me bits of meat to analyze in exchange for nectar. Thus, I have finally examined glassmaker physiology in depth. With that information, tonight I have constructed an astonishing idea. Mutualism can be coerced. Civilization can be imposed. It would solve the situation without barbarism. But it is a complex plan that would require cooperation from our entire ecology and an untested commitment from humans and plants alike. Its failure would result in worse disaster. A lamp is lit in Lucille's home. Her commitment to friendship inspired my idea. Cedar joins the guards and stalks the walls like an eagle. The restraint that has been imposed on her response to glassmaker attacks will make my plan possible. Glassmakers awaken. New musicians take up the concert. The large castes gather to plan the day's harassment of the city. They clumsily attempt to duplicate human bows and arrows. They have vandalized, but not set fire to my grove. Lucille arrives at the meeting house. I share the night's news of the drama of the Fippo Lions, and my humor route interjects. Perhaps the children could make them earplugs. This is nonsense, considering the lion's auditory apparatus, but nonsense is one kind of humor. She laughs and repeats the joke to Bartholomew when he arrives. More people come. I share my observations about glassmakers and bows, and after a discussion, Cedar concludes that the glassmakers lack experience to make a truly dangerous weapon.
They might learn fast, though,
she says. There is a loud screech of music.
I ought to put the poor little things out of their misery,
The worker caste is overworked and exhausted, I say. Cedar smiles unpleasantly. The meeting begins with all members of the committee, along with many citizens. Without farm work, they have little to do. Hunters sit far in the back, carefully chipping sharp edges onto glass arrowheads. I was not the only entity thinking overnight. Generation 4 hunters propose a surprise raid against the glassmaker camp. The master hunters are few in number, and age has made them fragile as dry reeds. But they are cunning, and their plan draws admiration for its boldness.
"The big thing is this," says their spokesman, Orion, whose sun-browned skin hangs in wrinkles that almost obscure his eyes. "We have to kill them all, or we have to deal with the survivors. They'll be hostile since we'll have wiped out their friends and family."
When he was young, he spent many years observing mountain spiders, and his knowledge eventually led to peaceful coexistence.
"But I think we should kill as few as possible anyway. Maybe just plaid blanket. That means a lot of prisoners. It's not a great plan, but it might work."
The plan has similarities to mine. Most of the support for his comes from farmers.
"They even cut down some protected locust wood trees,"
Hakon, a farmer, says.
"Steveland, the trees don't like that, do they?"
"Here is my chance." "They do not. Tulips are also angry, as are pineapples, cotton, wheat, lentils, others. They expect to be respected and cared for, but they understand that their animal allies have been subject to predation. The seed potatoes that you planted in the upriver sandy bottomland are complaining to me as we speak because they are being harvested before they can create a new generation."
"Our potatoes?"
Hakon says. "They complain," I continue, "but they are unable to act. We can act. I have a proposal. It is not entirely different from the hunter's proposal. Before the attack, we must disable the glassmakers by inserting stupefacients into their food. I believe I can persuade other plants to do this. When the glassmakers are helpless, we must remove their weapons and possessions. Then, to survive, they must cooperate with us. And we will teach them to behave with civilization. I think of it as domesticating the glassmakers, just as you domesticated the Phippolions." There is silence. Finally, someone says,
"But glassmakers smell."
There is laughter. "They bathed when they lived here," I say, causing more laughter, although the remark did not originate in my humor root.
"Cooperate?"
Hakon asks.
"Sure, they'll cooperate just long enough to get what they need to do us in."
"It will take much time and attention," I respond, "but the outcome will be tremendously beneficial to all of us."
"Stupefacients," Marie says quietly. "That's very tricky medication."
She is correct. I do not answer that observation.
"Why don't we just poison them?"
Hakon asks. Marie stares at him with anger, then at Orion.
"We have already set a goal of coexistence," she says slowly. No one moves.
Finally, Cedar says in a disbelieving tone,
"So we knock them out and take their weapons."
We take everything. I say, clothing, baskets, tents. Our response has been measured so far. They will see that we mean them no harm, but that we will force them to cooperate.
Maybe,
old Orion says.
They won't cooperate.
I agree that the plan has risks, I say. Its route is cautious development of mutual trust and cooperation through imposed non-violence. It will take significant patience and effort to force them to be our friends. In essence, we will conscript a symbiont. There is silence. I add as encouragement, this is often done by plants to animals.
Let's go over it step by step, Lucille says.
She seems interested, and her interest will encourage more interest. This plan is different from the procedure I used to lure the humans from their old village to this city, and yet the core remains the same. We must reward appropriate behavior until it becomes natural behavior. We are halfway through when I have to report glassmakers are on the move. Sentinels on the walls call out the same warning almost immediately. The entire force of the majors is en route. All 40 of them, and their trajectory seems to be the source of the water for the city. This could be disaster. The water flows from the springs to the city through pipes, and the springs are the most vulnerable part of the water system. I will notify the Bladeleaf Irises, I say. A decade ago, at my suggestion, we planted the irises to guard the springs and the pipeheads. Irises thirst for blood more than I do. They secrete anticoagulants on the glass-like lancets that cover their leaves, and above-ground roots are ready to absorb all blood that falls. The lancets are loosely attached, so if glassmakers try to mow them down, they will scatter clouds of glass blades, some small enough to be inhaled, and tear apart glassmakers' lungs from inside with 100 cuts.
That gives us time,
Cedar says, then turns and shouts. Call up the fighters. Archers and child messengers at the meeting run out. She shouts at me.
How long would it take to drug the glassmakers?
2 days. I must negotiate with other species, like tulips, for example, and they are shallow, slow thinkers. I must help them create the proper medications.
2 days,
Cedar says. She has begun to put on fighting gear, as have other pacifists.
Not good enough. They've got 40 majors, right? We should fight now. We can outnumber them 2-1, but that's counting everyone who can use a bow halfway decently, even Lucille. No offense, but you know what I mean. Everyone.
My roots from across the river report odd movement. The workers have ceased foraging and are returning to the camp. Will they cross the river to prevent us from protecting the springs?
We should attack their camp,
Orion says, meanwhile.
The big ones will still be trying to figure out the irises while we take control.
If they've seen the irises before,
Carl says,
they might give up right away.
I begin to flash the news about the workers' movements even as discussion continues. I wish I had a voice. A flute, a drum. Look at me. Cedar says,
the majors can turn around and be back in no time. We need to move.
Right.
Orion says,
So what if we take the females hostage?
No, we attack the majors.
Cedar says,
Now.
Marie reads my stem. Look at Steveland. The workers are up to something. Cedar waves her arms at me.
It's a trick.
Workers are not crossing the bridge, I report.
What's the trick?
Lucille asks. The workers have massed around the large tents that contain the females, I report. I do not understand their behavior. There seems to be a conflict. I could add that they are singing at each other, females at workers, workers at other workers, but this is clear to anyone with ears. Occasionally, I recognize a word that Marie had taught, but a vocabulary limited to terms like no, water, and hello has no real use. Cedar asks about the irises, but I am paying too close attention to the camp to answer. The voices rise like thunder. Workers fight and shed blood. The majors have stopped to listen, I report.
You really think we can live with the glassmakers?
Cedar shouts as she leaves. This is obviously a rhetorical question. I tell Lucille, the majors are turning around and may be headed back. Their speed is phenomenal.
I have to go look. Sorry.
Lucille leaves. At the camp, females argue with females, workers with workers, and workers with females. As the majors approach, some workers grab tools and cut down the rope bridge. The majors stand at the river edge, brandishing weapons, threatening to throw projectiles and shout at the workers and females, who shout back, and the noise causes my grove at the camp to become so dizzy that all growth stops. Humans on the wall have put their hands over their ears. Approximately 20 majors turn toward the city and address the humans emotionally, waving weapons. The females across the river also gesture at the city walls and speak with great agitation, as do the workers. But their comments amount to discordant commotion. Certain majors argue with the others. Suddenly, one of the majors addressing the humans is struck from behind with a sword, an expert blow that severs its head.
Another lunges to fight. Three majors grab it, and the fourth slices a sword. Both corpses are kicked with disrespect into the river. Orion shouts,
Show your weapons!
All along the wall, human fighters raise their bows. The glassmakers witness it, and a few majors jump into the river to swim across.
Lower your weapons! Remain steady!
The glassmakers absorb the warning and slowly fall silent. Orion's display is clever, clever, clever. It is rich fruit. It is a message that could not be more succinct, and it will support my plan. We could kill, but we will not. After a moment, the squabble among the glassmaker resumes, but subdued. The talk goes on for a long time. On the walls, children circulate with water, and later with food. I send some glucose to my sick grove at the glassmaker camp. The noise of glassmaker talk is now no more significant than a strong breeze.
It is afternoon when all the majors swim across the river, one by one, and without the natural skill of humans, although they are very buoyant, shaking themselves and their weapons dry as they climb out on the other side. Certain majors greet certain females, touching hands and heads, but most do not. The arguing workers have retreated, many returning to the fields to gather food. The singing and drumming does not resume. I think my proposal has been forgotten, and I learn of torrential rains over the mountains to the far west. These violent spring storms will not likely reach our valley, but if the river rises, that would complicate any attack. In the city, children nap and guards relax. An evening meal is prepared on both sides of the river, and suddenly several majors move quickly. They pick up weapons, surround three workers, and behead them. Blood flows into the soil. Soon I taste the iron. The music resumes. As the sun sets, debate begins anew in the meeting house. We need to do something, Lucille says.
Teach them civilization?
Hakon says.
They have that. It's just not like ours. That was murder. No excuse.
That's the point, Lucille says. That's what's so good about Stevelin's plan. No killing. Bartholomew stands up. He is an old woodworker, plump and gray-haired, who acts fussy but thinks sharply. He asks,
"What is the difference between taking the glassmakers prisoner and domesticating them?"
I begin to formulate a reply, but he continues,
"None. The question is, how many prisoners can we handle and how soon? You said 2 days, Stevelin?"
"Correct. Is he arguing for me or against me? I observed him and Lucille talking during the afternoon. Bartholomew is clever. He can take an idea and make it do the unexpected, as if it were a fipocat. And he has taught it to fly. And this is what he does. I never thought I was such a genius, and I have never before observed Lucille as hopeful, energetic, and persuasive. I had not realized my plan had so many advantages. It can almost fly."
"Pax,"
Bartholomew says.
"That's an ancient earth word for peace. Our ancestors came here to create peace. We know the price of war. All of us do, humans and bamboo. Destruction isn't the half of it. We would lose what we are. We are pacifists. It's time to live up to our name and make peace real."
Within an hour, the course is laid out. We will domesticate the glassmakers. So as night deepens, we begin. Lucille organizes planning groups. Outside the city, many plants begin as best they can to replenish their water loss from daytime, so the time is ideal to send them messages through roots. Calcium ions carry information from cell to cell in waves, each wave with its particular enzymes and chemicals, and each pathway among the cells creating meaning. Most plants speak similar chemical languages, and most can produce certain useful chemical compounds at will, just as animals can create tools or build reefs. It is a question of knowledge and sophistication. I start
with tulips, since they seem to be a favored food of the glassmakers, and since the only good time to talk to them is at night when they have closed their flowers. They do not have sufficient intelligence to maintain a flower and to communicate at the same time. Pests here, I say, sending the message through rootlets to 1,000 tulips.
Pests, bad, 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 bad.
They answer one by one. My humor root observes that they have little to say, but are talkative nonetheless. I am glad I grew the humor root. I can endure unpleasant situations better. The lentil trees planted among the tulips complain, too, about their own problems. I try to guess where the glassmakers will forage next on the tulips. Animal behavior is too flexible to be sure, especially among animals without prior commitments to the crops. But it seems obvious to guess that they will pillage the unharvested fields closest to their camp that are easily accessible from roads and paths. Helper here, I say to those fields of tulips. Helper chemical. Pest go. I show an endogenous opiate, and transport that information with a bit of biotin to make it more interesting. I introduced similar opiates 20 years ago in minor amounts into my medical fruits to cause relaxation and reduce anxieties. I hope this alkaloid in higher concentrations will produce more extreme effects in the glassmakers. Tulips already produce a phytohormone based on the amino acid phenylalanine. With a few additional steps, they can manufacture a heterocyclic nucleus that can become the alkaloid. I show the formula. I repeat this explanation dozens of times for each plant since they are slow learners. Molecules slip from my rootlets to theirs. It is tiring. I move some nitrogen from the city's gift center to their soil to help them. Half the nitrogen will get rerouted to create purine and pyrimidine bases to create RNA and aid in the tulip's own growth rather than to make the alkaloid. This is one reason they have responded so quickly. They are stupid. But self-interest is not related to intelligence. I hope for a sunny day tomorrow so they can work quickly. Lentils also snatch up the nitrogen and whine. They are waiting to be pruned. They are hapless plants that need assistance to determine the best way to arrange their leaves to gather sunlight.
Help me. Prune me.
The trees beg. Glassmakers are ignoring the lentils, although their buds and twigs are edible, as humans and scorpions know. I wish it were different. Lentils are always eager to help. Meanwhile, I contact the pineapples. They are intelligent, but stubborn. The agreement I brokered long ago between them and the humans was simple. The pineapples produce terminal tuft fruit in the spring and fall. Spring fruit must be replanted by the humans. Fall fruit may be harvested. Humans provide protection, cultivation, and labor. The pineapples add flavors and nutrients to fall fruits in exchange. But now their fruit is being harvested even though it is spring, and they are furious. I suggest drugging the spring fruit so that the glassmakers can be defeated and life can return to normal.
No,
I hear 800 times. Think about it, I say,
It is like flavoring your fruit. You do that according to contract. A common response says,
"Our terminal tufts are to be planted in spring, not harvested, not under any circumstances, and they are being eaten now."
You are not being eaten by the humans.
The humans must enforce the agreement. You own them.
We beg your help to overcome the predators.
Our contract includes protection from predators. We will add terpenes to make our fruit inedible.
I propose something better than terpenes, because intelligent animals might like terpenes the way they harvest pine wax. They can simply learn to burn the terpenes off. Your terminal tufts would make good torches that could be eaten.
Poison instead.
One plant says, and it becomes a chorus.
Poison, poison, poison.
Closer to my idea, but it is not necessary to kill the animals.
These animals should be killed. They are pests. Your animals would approve. The humans extirpate weeds. This would be like eliminating weeds.
It would not be like eliminating weeds. If a field is cleared of nettle, there is always nettle elsewhere. If the glassmakers are eliminated, there are no other glassmakers, and even if there were many, killing them would be uncivilized. But I do not explain that, since the pineapples could not understand that I am a pacifist. Instead, I say, we wish to domesticate these animals. We wish to control their behavior. They are too valuable to destroy.
You must make a contract with them.
A pineapple orders. Indeed, they must be taught how to make contracts.
The humans made a contract with us readily.
I had already domesticated the humans.
You must domesticate these pests.
Another pineapple says,
yes, domesticate them.
Others interject, I wish to domesticate them, and I need your help. Help us help you. I wait for their replies. Above us, stars shine. Bats swoop and whistle at each other. Thippolions howl, perhaps in protest to the glassmaker music. A wild lion answers. Far, far to the south, a thunderhead flashes and rumbles. Nighttime flowers scent the air. Lizards chirp. I isolate a grove from my root network for a moment and enjoy the night as a human might. Small in size, but intense in outlook. Entirely and pleasurably alert to nothing beyond my immediate surroundings, a luxury I can take only for a moment, but it is amazing how being small is a qualitative rather than a quantitative difference. The shape of the external world changes. I return my attention to my network of roots. Lentils continue to whimper. Most pacifists and glassmakers sleep. One by one, the pineapples agree and pressure their neighbors to join the majority. I show them how to combine urea and malonic acid to make barbituric acid, and I transport some urea from the gift center to close the contract. And so the night goes. Leeks, potatoes, yams, lettuce. I did not expect to hear from the locust wood trees.
Their custom is to select a speaker based on seniority and health, which means the biggest and most aggressive. It also becomes the sole breeding male. Their sexuality is bipolar but elective. The theory of evolution brought by humans from Earth explains the outcome. They are self-selecting for escalating aggression, and they had already achieved significant success before human protection allowed for a supermature speaker.
What do we get, bamboozler?
The locustwood speaker asks.
We are being cut down by the intruders. We value our relationship with the city animals, too. We have much to offer.
A taste of ethylene in the message makes my rootlets freeze as the auxins are inhibited. As I said, he is aggressive. I try to respond with self-assurance, but I can barely squeeze out. What exactly can you offer? All they make is decorative wood and edible autumnal seed pods.
We propose a reasonable concession in the future in exchange for additional planting in the southern forest land.
We need help now, I say. He extrudes more ethylene.
We will fulfill your reasonable request whenever you make it. Be warned, we will not make this offer again. If you wish our help, this is our demand.
I am distracted. The lentils are sobbing. As kindly as I can, I say to the lentils, we understand your problem and will help you soon. Painful blasts of ethylene from several locust wood trees get my attention. Tatiana would have called this extortion. I have nothing for you to do, I say.
We will do anything reasonable, but in exchange, we want a southern colony. This is important to us.
My humor route suggests moving them all far to the south. An old route notices that the speaker's communication skills and perhaps intelligence have made a quantum leap with age.
We have excess ethylene,
the speaker says.
That would hurt many plants, including pineapples and tulips.
I have no choice but to agree. You know that.
We offer a fair bargain.
If Tatiana were alive, she would offer useful suggestions for coping with delinquency. But she is dead, and I need to answer quickly before my roots suffer permanent damage. I agree. When conditions allow additional planting, planting will be done. But be prepared to follow my orders when I give them. My humor route suggests ordering suicide. Meanwhile, I have begun to communicate with the snow vine that grows along the river. This could be crucial. I can use the vine's instinct to control animals to make it do what I want. New animal to control, I say. It has never realized that it is being used as a dike to stabilize the riverbanks during floods. It has easy access to water. It has attention. It thinks it is the ruler of the riverbanks and the master of the humans. The glassmakers are using it to grow their snowflake-shaped scale bugs, and workers in particular like to eat the bugs, provided there are some left after the larger castes are done eating. You must control bugs, I say.
Bugs no eat fruit,
it answers. In other words,
How can you control an animal except with fruit? Change sap for bugs. Like this, I show a chemical. Sap will control animals.
Bugs no eat fruit.
Bugs drink sap.
Yes,
it says.
Bugs no eat fruit.
Change sap for bugs because bugs drink sap. No eat